welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, Deep Politics, the Deep State, and Dark Events. Our first guest is author, scholar, poet, and former diplomat Peter Dale Scott, a longtime researcher on the topic in its many guises from JFK to 9/11. We'll be discussing his recent article, The State, the Deep State, and the Wall Street Overworld. The show continues with independent journalist and filmmaker Christina Borgeson concerning the TWA Flight 800 event, about which she recently produced a comprehensive documentary film investigating the many unresolved controversies there. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program will be looking at deep politics, the deep state, and dark events. Our first guest will be Peter Dale Scott, and in the bottom of the hour, we'll be speaking with journalist and filmmaker Christina Borgeson. But here is Peter Phillips to introduce our first guest. Peter?
Oh, we're so glad to have Peter Dale Scott in studio with us today. He's a Canadian diplomat, professor emeritus at UC Berkeley, leading political analyst, and highly regarded poet. His most recent books are The Road to 9/11, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America, The War Conspiracy, JFK, 9/11, and the Deep Politics of War, Drugs, Oil, and War, and the U.S. and Afghanistan, Colombia, and Indochina, and The American War Machine, which I used in my class last year. Very important books. So, Peter, welcome.
I'm glad to be back.
It's really nice to have you here. We've been reading this new piece you wrote, The State, the Deep State, and the Wall Street Overworld. You define the deep state as a level of government or super control that exists regardless of elections that may thwart popular movements or radical change, such as in Egypt and other places. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. It's become a very fashionable word, really, since Morsi was overthrown in Egypt, and it looked like nothing had really changed in Egypt, so people started talking about a deep state. I've been talking about it for about 10 years, and there are some people on the left who quite reasonably say, well, you know, the deep state is just a deeper level of the state. But I think it's an important concept. I've gone back and forth on it. I was a little ambivalent when I wrote American War Machine. I have a page or two saying how it's a very waffly concept, that you shouldn't imagine some structure, some control room where the world is being managed by a higher level. That was the trouble with Fletcher Prouty and his secret team, that there was a group of people who could manage everything. But I think we need the notion. You know, America was set up to have limited government. It's a bit hard to remember that now with the NSA and CIA and everything, but we were set up with the potential, back in the 18th century, potential for a strong economy and very limited government. And from the beginning, there have been people who manipulated that. Anyone who studied the creation of the Federal Reserve, for example, know that it was a team of bankers who went down to an island in South Carolina, and they figured out what law they wanted, and the law was really determined there by people who weren't in government at all. So that's an example of what I mean by the deep state.
That was the creation of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Of course, Roosevelt wrote to Colonel House when he was first took office that you and I know that a group of on Wall Street have run this country for a century. It's not an exact quote, but roughly it. And I do think Wall Street, in that sense, certainly was in power up to and through the first decade after World War II. And by Wall Street, I don't just mean banks and law firms, but I also mean the industrial arrangements that they were responsible for, because we had an era of cartels, and the most striking one being the oil cartel. You had the Seven Sisters in those days, seven companies, five of them American, plus what's now BP and Shell. They had legal arrangements which were designed on Wall Street. Actually, John Foster Dulles was the mastermind in the 30s. And I have a quote in the article from him. You have the paper, I don't, but in effect, he said, we have to do these things because politicians don't know how the world really has to be run. And that confidence at that level is what you might call the mindset of the people in the deep state. John Foster Dulles was an example. His brother Alan was an even more conspicuous one. And I give examples to show that he was just as powerful, maybe more so, or at least as powerful, when he was just a Wall Street lawyer as he was when he finally joined the agency which he had helped design and create, which was the CIA.
So this all goes back to World War II in particular, where we mm-hmm. see the consolidation of our national security agencies under the Office of Strategic Services, and then, of course, the creation of the CIA immediately thereafter. So what was interesting to me in your piece was the degree to which right after World War II, the excess money from the Germans and from Japan was used not only for covert actions by the intelligence agencies, but it was funneled through private corporations.
Right.
And that was new to me in reading this piece. I did not know that Lockheed and the major oil companies were actually using government money or funding government money for various anti-communist activities.
Well, let's break that down into sections. The element right through is that the CIA has never operated within its own budget. It's always had access to more money. The first phase was SS funds, which were captured by the OSS, so-called Operation Safe Haven. And it was that money that was used to back the right-wing parties in the 1948 Italian election. It wasn't a U.S. budget. It was they had these funds. And then a second stage was the Marshall Plan. There was an enormous amount of aid went to Western Europe. But there was a secret slice of the Marshall aid budget, which was reserved again for covert operations, splitting the labor movement in France and getting control of using drug trafficking mafia, really, Corsicans, to get control of the dockside in Marseille, which was important for supporting the French in Indochina. And then the third stage would be major, major arms deals, and there's a succession of them. This is where a man called Adnan Khashoggi appears. He's an Arab. He's a student at Chico. He was here in America, and he started by selling trucks. But the first thing you knew, he got $100 million just from Lockheed. And that money was partly for him. He got an enormous yacht, an enormous private airplane. But he was using it to, again, fund the same sort of people, right-wing parties all over the world. And this is no secret. There was a book, a mainstream book about Khashoggi. The title was The Richest Man in the World, which I think he probably was for a while, until Congress outlawed these kickbacks on arms deals. But this source of funding has continued. There was the AWACS that was sold to Saudi Arabia in the early 1980s under Reagan. And once again, money kicked back from the deal was used to fund the Contras in Nicaragua and also the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. So these were the biggest CIA operations of the time, and they weren't being paid for by the U.S. taxpayer. They were being... it still goes on, by the way, this basic sort of flow that U.S. dollars go to Saudi Arabia for oil, and then they come back to buy arms, and then a slice of the money that's paid for the arms is put into a special fund to fund covert operations. Now, the final stage I have to mention, I didn't get much space in the article, was in the 1990s when the huge arms deal was with Britain, because Congress is becoming more and more trying to... This is a challenge to Congress. You know, Congress is trying to say what the CIA will do, and the CIA is saying, well, we're going to do what we want, whether Congress authorizes it or not. And so the last deal was with BAE in Britain, who they're pretty big here now, too, but it is a British firm. And this was $1 billion went to Prince Bandar, who was the Saudi ambassador in Washington, and he put it into the Riggs Bank. And some of that money funded some of the alleged hijackers in 9/11. So from this point of view of the deep state, you see a kind of continuity. I didn't mention the October surprise in 1980, Iran-Contra, and then finally 9/11. These are a series of apparently unconnected deep events that afflict our politics from time to time. But up at the level of the deep state, they're not so unconnected. They're being funded from a single source. And we're never really going to get control of our politics and wrest it away from the deep state, from the CIA, the NSA, and so on, until we see clearly that they have ways of funding their operations, which right now are not just beyond congressional control, but they're actually designed to frustrate congressional control. There's a famous quote from Prince Turki when he's talking about the Safari Club in the late 1970s. That was a club of the intelligence chiefs of France, Iran, Saudi Arabia. And why did they get together? And he says very frankly, because Congress was limiting the CIA, and so we had to do something else.
We're speaking with author and scholar Peter Dale Scott, discussing his most recent research, The State, the Deep State, and the Wall Street Overworld. Peter Dale Scott, just this week we saw in the Senate Dianne Feinstein putting on a theatrical performance about how outraged she was about CIA spying on the Senate when she had clearly supported their spying on others prior to that. But that's an example right here and now.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are days I'm a pessimist and days I'm an optimist. But if you take the last year, first and chiefly, after Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning, then there was Edward Snowden, and the revelations about the NSA, that really shook Congress. They said, you know, why are we here? We pass laws, and all these things are done by secret courts that we have no view of. And that's what I think. Actually, Ed Snowden did more even than Egypt to popularize the notion of the deep state in the last year, because it's really gone viral in the last 6 months or so. And now with Dianne Feinstein, if it was just that one event alone, it would come up and then it would disappear. But if we have enough of these things happening together, it could be like when Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers in 1972, when you suddenly had a change in the balance of power, and everyone was fearing Nixon, the imperial presidency, he could control everything. Well, what a joke. He became the first president who had to resign, because you can get, if you can mobilize public opinion, you can get a climate change in this country, and it's really defeatist not recognize that that is possible. We should build on these things.
It certainly is, but it's also the case in the sense the CIA and the deep state elements are well aware of the power and role of media. That's why it was referred to as the mighty Wurlitzer.
Yeah, right.
And Operation Mockingbird and the rest to try to control and mobilize.
They do control the mainstream media, or what I prefer to call the governing media, but they're not the only media now. With the internet, I think there's the potential for a real change.
Well, of course, you mentioned Snowden, and he came out of a company called Booz Allen and Hamilton, which has a long history in your article here of being government-funded CIA, closely working with Wall Street. Tell us a little bit about them and their history.
Well, we have to, first of all, go back to, I would say, 1953. Eisenhower comes in. The two Dulles brothers, one is Secretary of State, the other is now head of the CIA. This is the year that a management consulting company that's been around for a long time decides to go international. And it's very interesting that their first efforts, international efforts, are in three countries, Philippines, Iran, and Egypt, which are also the scene of major CIA operations at the time. The CIA had a hand in getting rid of King Farouk and in installing first Naguib and then Nasser. John Foster Dulles turned against Nasser because the British didn't like them because it happened to the Suez Canal. But originally, the CIA liked him. And there's, in connection with Booz Allen Hamilton, I have to mention one of their early top people left the CIA. He had helped overthrow Mossadegh in Iran in 53, and then he, quote, resigned from the CIA. He went over to Booz Allen Hamilton, and he became the top U.S. government contact with Nasser, higher than the ambassador, higher than the station chief. It was Miles Copeland. And then after a while, he resigned from, and he himself says it was technically a resignation. He didn't really resign. He, up on that deep state level, it doesn't matter if you're in or you're out, you're part of that milieu. And he, quote, resigned from Booz Allen Hamilton to go and work with this, who, guess who, Adnan Khashoggi. So suddenly you have a very senior CIA operative who's at the right hand of Khashoggi when he's dispensing millions to governments all over the world, which come from Lockheed contracts, which are from this basic sort of funding system.
And you talk about that as the revolving door.
Oh, everybody does.
Yes, right.
Yes. Yeah. You know, the example in the article is that, you have it more than me, but the people who are running the CIA and who they come out of Booz Allen Hamilton, they go back into Booz Allen Hamilton. And most of the budgeting now for secret operations in Washington, the war on terrorism, 70% of that is outsourced. And so you have, I think it's more than 100,000 people who have secret clearances who are not part of the government. Edward Snowden was one of those people. And there's very little control on them. That's this Lofgren article that came out and he was on the Bill Moyer show recently. That's what really concerns him, that the Congress has lost control of this whole second level of government, the deep state. I'm worried about what I just call the third level. It's the people who are designing the policies and directions for what's happening in Washington, the really meta level. That's what I mean by the overworld.
Is that a Wall Street overworld, or is it a transnational corporate class overworld?
It's certainly transnational now, yes. A lot, there've been, you know, this is not a steady state that we're in, and what the status of Wall Street has changed a lot since the 1950s, where it was so clearly, you know, policies were made in the Council on Foreign Relations. I think the Vietnam War ended that, and the rise of the military-industrial complex ended that. And I regard the two decades between 1960 and 1980 as a time of really almost a deep state takeover. It culminates with the Reagan Revolution. And I don't really spell this out in the article, but I don't believe we would have had the Reagan Revolution if we hadn't had huge oil price increases under Carter, which sank him, made it impossible for him to be reelected. Plus the October surprise, which, for those of you who were younger, too young to remember that era, there were these hostages, American hostages, taken in Tehran, and to get them out, Carter was negotiating, but the Republicans, who were not in power, were also negotiating to make sure that Iran wouldn't give them back until Reagan was elected. And this is what elected Reagan. And this was, to me, a safari club operation. A Frenchman called Alexandre de Maranche, who was a key figure in the safari club of the intelligence chiefs, was also one of the masterminds of the October surprise. And so Wall Street is not the power that it was, in a sense. You know, the Sun Belt, the military-industrial complex, is essentially based in Texas and California. And many things have happened. Big oil companies in New York have migrated down to Texas because the laws are more favorable to them down there. So Wall Street, you have to be careful using the word now. But historically, it engendered this situation. And what it stands for is still true. true, even though you said it properly. It is transnational now, and that's the conclusion of my article, that these things are going on at a higher level. This, I quote from a an analysis of the key, the kind of work that you two guys do. You know, where is this corporate power ultimately concentrated? And some people recently came up with a list of, I think, 20 companies, and I think only four of them are literally on Wall Street. And one of the ones that is, the Bank of New York, is a really very shady bank that is doesn't represent traditional banking. It was siphoning money out of Russia under Yeltsin and is involved in many different ways.
With kind of the new BCCI.
It's, yes, well, part of it, yes, definitely. BCCI, for those of you, again, who are too young, was the bank for the Safari Club, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. It was originally a Pakistani bank, but the Saudis and the various Gulf states, Emirates, took it over and made it a kind of cash register for covert operations from the Safari Club. And they were closed down in 1990, mostly by Robert Morgenthau in New York, who saw that it was not good for Israel, this BCCI. But there are successor banks, yes.
Peter Dale Scott, it's been a pleasure to sit down and pick your brain and hear what you're doing these days. Thanks so much for coming in and talking about the state, the deep state, and the Wall Street overworld.
Okay, thanks to both of you.
Coming up next, we have Project Censored's Validated Independent News with Project Censored intern Alexandria McDowell. She's speaking about wage theft.
I'm Alexandria McDowell with today's Validated Independent News story. In recent news, the debate over minimum wage has moved to center stage in the United States. As the divide between the wealthy and poor grows, unfair wages characterize work all across the country. The story of employers failing to adhere to the existing minimum wage, that story, however, deserves more attention. In an October 2013 report from the Economic Policy Institute, it aims to do just that. It points out that when employers fail to adhere to minimum wage laws or to pay overtime, they effectively steal wages from workers. University of Oregon economist Gordon Laffier wrote in a report that, quote, "The country suffers an epidemic of wage theft as large numbers of employers violate minimum wage, overtime, and other wage and hour laws with virtual impunity," end quote. The report titled "The Legislative Attack on America Wages and Labor Standards" indicates that in 2008, wage theft topped $185 million, according to the Department of Labor data. That is three times more than all the money lost in bank, gas station, and convenience store robberies that same year. According to the 2009 survey also cited in the report, more than 60% of low-wage workers have some pay illegally withheld by their employer each week. Low-paid workers lose a stunning $2,634 per year on average in unpaid wages, or up to 15% of their income. Such workplace abuses are occurring as some of the most powerful corporate lobbyists attack standards and workplace protections, including minimum wage laws, paid sick leave, and even child labor protections. Economic Policy Institute Vice President Ross Eisenbray observed that according to their statistics from 1983 to 2010, the bottom 60% of Americans actually lost wealth, despite the fact that the overall U.S. economy has grown over this same time period. He is quoted as saying that this is a remarkable indictment of how our economy is not working for everybody, end quote. The war on poverty is failing. Major corporations are continuing to commit crimes against honest, low-wage, hardworking Americans with no consequences for their actions. The Council for Economic Advisers for the White House estimates that if we raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour by 2016, we would lift roughly 1.6 million workers whose wages are currently near the minimum wage and members of their family out of poverty. However, these estimated benefits depend on if employers follow the actual laws. When there are few consequences for corporations that fail to adhere to existing labor laws, then there is no incentive for them to do the right thing by the hardworking citizens of our country. This has been Alexandria McDowell for Project Censored. For more validated independent news, go to projectcensored.org and follow the link for validated news.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We continue today's program, our theme, Deep Politics, the Deep State, and Dark Events. We are joined now by journalist and filmmaker Christina Borgeson. She was formerly with CBS and CNN. She is also editor of a couple of fantastic books on media and media censorship, Feet to the Fire, also Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of a Free Press. She is also a recent documentary filmmaker of the TWA Flight 800 documentary. And Christina joins us today not only to talk about the documentary, but to talk about recent attacks and censorship regarding the film and the topic itself. Christina Borgeson, you're with us.
Hi. How are you, Mickey?
Doing really well. Welcome back to the program. It's always a delight to have you on the program.
Thank you.
And we can, you know, again, maybe certainly talk about some recent events, but also, you know, maybe talk a little bit more about that subtitle there, that myth of a free press, something that you've long chronicled and discussed. But to tell listeners again about your film, TWA Flight 800, and then let's talk a little bit about what's been happening in the news media about that on CNN and so forth.
Well, TWA Flight 800, it is an investigative documentary that looks at what happened to the plane that crashed off the coast of Long Island back in July 1996 under mysterious circumstances. And with hundreds of eyewitnesses having seen all or part of what occurred, many of whom said they saw a rocket or a flare or something going up to meet the plane. 17 years later, we produced this documentary, which is the first and only documentary that features six whistleblowers who were members of the original official investigation, including the two lead investigators, the one for TWA and one for the National Transportation Safety Board, and medical examiner, NTSB's medical forensic expert. And these are all people who handled the evidence and had the expertise to assess it. In our film, they conclude that what caused the plane's demise was one or more ordnance explosions occurring outside the aircraft. Now, the other thing that these guys talk about and document and name names is how the original official investigation was undermined by members and agents of the CIA, FBI, and the NTSB, with the help of the NTSB leadership. So anyway, our documentary came out, and there is no speculation at all in this documentary. There are no third-hand sources, whatever. These are all first-hand sources. And so it was quite a shock to a lot of reporters who had done official source reporting and misreported and continue to this day misreport a number of key points related to this crash. Now, here we have Malaysia Air, and it's very interesting how this happens. Malaysia Air occurs, and all of a sudden, TWA comes to everybody's mind, the mystery part, but also, you know, the conspiracy theory aspect. Oh, nobody knows what happened here. And, you know, all of a sudden we start getting this attention, and Peter Bergen, who is CNN's national security analyst, I don't know if he knows anything about airplanes, I don't know if he knows anything about any technical information about aviation accident investigation, whatever, and he writes this piece for CNN. The piece was called When Passenger Jets Mysteriously Disappear. And the hook, of course, was the Malaysia Air, but he immediately jumps into TWA 800 because the whole point of the article is to say, oh, when something like this happens, the conspiracy theorists jump in, just like they did with TWA. And then he proceeds to talk about TWA. He presents the same persistent inaccurate information that has been presented all along. I just want to talk about some of those just briefly, okay? The first inaccurate thing is they say that the NTSB determined that the cause of the crash was an explosion in the center wing fuel tank. That is not true. The NTSB has never, ever found a definitive cause of the crash. In fact, their own fire and explosives group chairman, okay, said that the center wing tank explosion was most likely a secondary event. But because this was put out as the cause, they take out probable, and that's what the NTSB said was probable. Even, and they put that out, even though their own fire and explosives guy says, now it's probably a secondary event, not the initiating event. But meanwhile, that has hardened, that perception has hardened into common public knowledge that the NTSB found that that was the cause of the crash. When there, it's simply not true. So that's one thing that Peter Bergen, in his piece for CNN, put out. The eyewitnesses, they always say, oh, those eyewitnesses, nobody pays attention to them. They're not reliable. Actually, the eyewitness reports are strikingly consistent. And guess what? They dovetail with the forensic evidence. And even the FBI team that was sent out to interview eyewitnesses about, particularly the ones who had seen a streak go up, said in their report that, yes, most likely what they saw was a missile. Explosive traces were found throughout the plane. But the FBI came out and said, oh, no, there were only a few. There were a bunch of frequent false positives, and there were only a few, and those were because of some dog-sniffing exercise where some of the explosives for the dog to sniff out, in it was a dog that ostensibly took place in this plane before it became TWA Flight 800, and there were some traces of explosives left from that. Well, not only was that debunked, and I won't go into a long explanation about why, but there were explosives not just in traces inside the plane, but on the outside, the exterior wreckage. So anyway, the FBI lied about that. The other thing is the missile evidence. They say, oh, there's no evidence, no evidence whatsoever that of missile damage in the wreckage. Well, there's a lot of it, particularly for a proximity fuse missile engagement. There are, and I'm just going to read them off. There's internal penetrations and fractures into the fuselage from the outside, more than 100 high-energy fractures found throughout the airframe, explosive traces throughout the wreckage, telltale random damage pattern, localized recrystallization of aluminum, that's like when aluminum gets super, super hot, and radar evidence of debris moving away from the plane at Mach 4. That's four times the speed of sound. So, and the other thing they always say is, oh, yeah, all these agencies that were part of this agree that the fuel air explosion in the center wing tank caused the crash. Even that's not true. The Airline Pilots Association questioned it. TAWA never signed on to it. Boeing did not sign on to it. And the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. And all of these were parties to the investigation. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers said the TWA 800 crash was associated with at least one southbound moving object external to the aircraft penetrating the fuselage's left side. So all these things, you know, are just shunted aside, and Peter Bergen comes forward and uses this Malaysia Air incident as an opportunity to try and stuff the facts back into the conspiracy bin.
Christina, hi, this is Peter Phillips. So we're talking with Christina Borgeson, who's been following this TWA Flight 800 now for some 17 years, originally working with CBS and then later CNN, and looking at this as a long history where you finally produced a movie, which is pretty overwhelming, presents all your evidence in terms of what's happened. Yet we continue to see Peter Bergen from CNN writing this piece, when passenger jets mysteriously disappear, reclaiming this is just a conspiracy theory, using that negation of anybody that questions things that are happening. And in this case, the evidence is increasingly overwhelming. You've got hundreds of witnesses and everything. So is Peter Bergen part of the mighty, mighty Wurlitzer of just lying, and he knows he is? Or is he part of a culture that just can't address these issues in any open way?
Peter Bergen specifically is kind of interesting because before I came on here, I wanted to do a little research into, you know, who is Peter Bergen? You know, what has he done? And I found another reporter who wrote a rebuttal to a story that Peter Bergen had done, and it was Chris Woods of the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. And, you know, they're a UK, they're a nonprofit UK outfit, and they have done a lot of work on tracking the civilian deaths resulting from drone strikes in Pakistan, et cetera. And Chris Woods writes an article in July 2012, how CNN analyst Peter Bergen is misleading the public on killer drones. And he writes this whole article. It's on Alternet if anybody's interested in seeing it. It's this whole article about how Peter keeps downplaying the numbers and keeps misreporting the numbers. In other words, the misreporting is to say there were no drone strikes in this instance, or that there were very fewer drone strikes than there actually were. So it's very, very interesting, the subjects that he chooses to misreport on. And so I looked a little further, and he's part of the New America Foundation, which is interesting in itself because, generally speaking, a reporter who's part of a think tank, you know, this is supposed to be a nonpartisan think tank, but, you know, nonpartisan, nobody really knows what that means anymore. And his think tank, by the way, in 2013 got more than $1 million from, guess who, the U.S. Department of State. I don't think that Bergen ever, when he puts out his articles, writes any sort of full disclosure statement about how his foundation gets money from the Department of State. So, you know, there's a problem. You know, if you're going to present yourself as a journalist, you got to make sure your facts are straight.
But we know historically, Christina, that some journalists have direct contacts with the intelligence agencies. We call them historically mockingbird journalists. And if we see someone who takes the Malaysian flight and then writes an article using it to, again, debase any questions about Flight 800, let alone writing, working for a foundation that's getting money from the State Department, and in turn writing and downplaying the significance of drones, wouldn't you think that this person has another agenda besides being an objective journalist?
He's clearly not reporting the facts. And I will say this, certainly, about the CIA's connection to the TWA Flight 800 story. The CIA did create the ultimate disinformation vehicle for discrediting the eyewitnesses in this case. They were the ones who put together an animation that was physically impossible, aerodynamically impossible, to explain why the eyewitnesses did not see what they saw. That animation, which was commissioned ostensibly, or the FBI said, you know, FBI's Jim Kallstrom said that they had commissioned the CIA to do it. Why they commissioned the CIA, I don't know. Because, you know, the CIA does not have a reputation. I mean, the CIA's reputation is not one of being, you know, honest. I mean, they're actually in the business of being dishonest. But anyway, the CIA did this animation, which they handed over to the FBI. The FBI's Jim Kallstrom presented it in a press conference, and then the FBI basically used that to recuse themselves from the criminal investigation and to wrap up that criminal investigation. And the next thing you know, the hearings came on. Eyewitnesses were prohibited from testifying at these NTSB hearings, at the final hearing, which is, it's unprecedented in NTSB history that eyewitnesses are not allowed to testify. And as a matter of fact, in that final hearing, there several key eyewitnesses' accounts were misrepresented on the record by Mr. David Mayer of the NTSB, who was the head of the eyewitness group, a second eyewitness group, I should say. There was an initial one. And then the probable cause, as I mentioned here, probable. It was not only never proven, but as I say, their own fire and explosives guy said that it was probably a secondary event. They went ahead and presented the probable cause, and that has hardened into common public knowledge. So, you know, clearly there is an effort, in this case, a multi-agency collusion effort of collusion to keep the facts of the forensic evidence. And that's what we dealt with, just the forensic evidence. And I will tell you something else about this that always strikes me is when I send out this information about, for example, when I sent out this team rebuttal on Bergen's article to some of my colleagues, one colleague wrote back to me and said, well, yeah, but, you know, what about the overarching question? You didn't answer the overarching question of what would the FBI's motive be if they were actually looking for a terrorist bomber missile? What would their motive be to cover up? And I just thought to myself, I'm presenting you with forensic evidence. I'm presenting you with hundreds of eyewitnesses who saw this thing and whose accounts dovetail with the forensic evidence. Why do you think motive is the most important thing? I said, look, I'm trying to bring these guys to court so that they can explain what their motives are. But first and foremost is not motive. First and foremost is the evidence.
Christina Borges, and you hit it right there. And as someone that teaches critical thinking, I have to hammer that in, that message out day after day. Because anytime you're looking for the evidence and you are asking questions, you know, it's really easy to go into the red herring or the straw person kind of fallacious paths. It's also, of course, a classic tactic of people to attack and label, certainly using the conspiracy theorist label. But again, you know, that's because folks are just not focusing on the hard evidence. And in fact, you posted a rebuttal. You wrote a rebuttal to Peter Bergen, and it's posted at the dailycensored.com website for Project Censored. And you write here, Bergen, his last five words are based on these past cases. And of course, it includes cases where he has facts incorrect. And you write, he fails to provide one instance of hard evidence to back up his statements. The antidote to conspiracy theories is hard evidence. The deleterious effects to American society of Bergen's work here, combined with that of many other veteran reporters who have persisted in inaccurately reporting on issues of great public interest, including TWA Flight 800 and equally notoriously the run-up to the Iraq War, are immeasurable. In a nutshell, we only have about a minute left, but that is a serious problem that we face in our society, and a particular woeful failure of free press.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And you know, I keep talking about calling these reporters out individually for their corruption. And I'll tell you, what I get from the journalism community is silencio. There is an omerta on that, and that has got to be broken.
Well, we certainly support your effort there here at Project Censored, and we're delighted to have you back on. And could you give listeners a website or two? You have an entire website, I believe, for fact-checking on your film. Can you give a couple websites quickly?
Yes, our website is flight800doc.org. And if you go and click on the fact-checking section, you will see other rebuttals of other reporters' work that we've done.
Thanks so much for joining us, Christina Borgeson.
You're welcome.
You are listening to Project Censored Show. It's originating here in Berkeley, California. For archives of the shows, go to projectcensored.org. Please keep tabs and like us on Facebook. Thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, and Rod Akeel. We will see you next time.